The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So many of you know that I've been giving a series of talks all winter long to the spring on the four foundations of mindfulness. And I think I'm still kind of in that mode of that series. So it goes on and on. And one of the purposes of mindfulness that's given in this text is for the attainment of liberation, of nibbana, nirvana. And it's said to be the direct road, a direct path to this attainment of freedom. And the word nibbana, or nirvana in English, one of the primary ways in which it's presented in the teachings of the Buddha is as a form of liberation, and liberation from greed, hate, and delusion. It's the primary way it's characterized. More than, you know, some kind of state that, you know, some kind of transcendent state or ultimate state you're supposed to experience. It's mostly described by the absence, what you're free from. And Buddhism, Buddhist practice, can be seen as a journey to that kind of liberation. And it's, I think for some people it's very hopeful or encouraging to think of it as a journey, because it implies you don't have to be stuck where you're at. And if you are, you know, having a very difficult time in your life and difficult time with your own mind, you don't have to be stuck there. It's there's a path, there's a unfolding you can be involved in, that you can engage in, that you can participate in. And that unfolding, that evolution, is said to be as natural as water running down a mountain. So just as the, or down across the plains of India, the one saying is that just as the Ganges rivers incline, slopes, flows eastward, so this path of liberation flows, inclines, moves towards liberation, towards freedom. So the idea of using a river as a metaphor kind of suggests a natural movement. This is kind of a, this is a direction that flows if you go into this path of practice. So as a journey. And it has an interesting kind of way station along the way, something that we're working towards in order for some of the core elements of liberation to kind of unfold in our minds or in our hearts. And that is to have your mind settled and peaceful enough so that the mind can be impacted by the insights that mindfulness provide. And the particular insight that's most strongly emphasized is that of impermanence, seeing the changing nature of phenomena, seeing how things arise and pass. And it's amazing how much in the teaching of the Buddha that particular insight is emphasized over and over again. But in order for that insight to have an impact, the mind has to be ripe, has to be prepared. And I like to, one of the ways that a ripe mind is described is with his following words. Don't get discouraged if it sounds too grand. So it's a mind that's pure, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attain to imperturbability. It's pretty nice, huh? And so some of these, like the word malleable and wieldy, means that the mind is can be worked. It's soft enough that it can be influenced by good things. If the mind is hard and stiff and contracted, there can't be anything that impacts it. It can't do this, the movement of deep, this deep movement of liberation. So part of the path of practice is to calm down, brighten the mind. I love the word bright. Make it pure, pure from its imperfections, from its ways in which we're caught up in unhelpful states of mind and activities. And you can actually feel in a visceral, direct way the experience of the heart, the mind, feeling pure, feeling certain kind of cleanly. Sometimes the word cleanliness is used. So steady, calm, relaxed, clean, steady, bright, or some of these words. So with a mind like that, then insight, the impact of insight can happen. So a journey. One of the ways that this journey unfolded in the time of the Buddha was a number of cases. There's like 25, I don't know how many, but there's a number of cases in the suttas where the journey unfolds while someone's listening to a Dharma talk. And they say that the journey to liberation can also happen while someone's giving a Dharma talk. So I'm always hoping. So the Buddha sometimes would see or somehow sense that a person was ready, got close towards the possibility of the potential of being awakened, being liberated. And then he would give a particular kind of Dharma talk. And one of those cases was when there was a leper who was looking for food or some kind of assistance, and he saw a crowd of people. And thought, oh, over there I can get some help or some food. And so he wandered over there, and there was a crowd of people listening to the Buddha giving a talk. And so he stood on the edge listening to that, but the Buddha saw him there and said, oh, that man, he is ready. He has the capability of liberation. So he directed his talk to him. And we don't know great details of what the Buddha taught, but he gave a fivefold a Dharma talk on around five themes, which I see as kind of a journey. And in order to prepare this man to have the mind to hear the liberation teachings. And those five themes in the Dharma talk were generosity, virtue, the heavens, the heavenly realms, the danger of sensual pleasures, and the bliss of renunciation. And the Buddha, being a brilliant Dharma teacher, inspired the leper in a profound way, really inspired him. And here's a description of what this inspired mind, how the Buddha inspired this. So that the leper's mind became ready, receptive, free from hindrances, elated, and confident. Another great bunch of concepts for how you can be in your mind. So similar to the first description, the mind is kind of inspired and bright, in a heightened state of beautiful kind of qualities. So the Buddha brings this leper into this state by giving this Dharma talk. And so there's something about the journey of first learning about generosity. Generosity is one of the beautiful qualities of heart that some people live by. Many years ago, there was a TV show in America called Mr. Rogers. And Mr. Rogers was probably one of the great American saints. And it was the only TV show that I allowed our young kid to watch, because I think everyone should watch it. Grown-ups should watch Mr. Rogers. Very wholesome, very beautiful man. And so he got an award once, Academy Awards, or I don't know what it was, some great award, and for his wonderful TV show for kids. And he got up on stage to receive his award and give his little speech. And he said to all the like movie stars, mostly, I guess, sitting there in their gowns and suits, and you know. And he said something like, you know, all of us here today are here because someone believed in us and was generous. Let's take a minute to think about those people and remember them. And so then he was silent, which the people producing the TV show were probably horrified. You know, a minute of silence on TV is kind of a long time. And so they didn't know what to do, so I guess they scanned the audience, and there were all these, not all, but some of the people, they were crying, thinking about, you know, who had supported them, believed in them, had been generous. And it's phenomenal how much generosity exists in this world that we live in. And it's sad when we don't realize it. Sad when it's too easy. American culture, I think, is often set up in such a way that we often don't appreciate or sense or feel how much American culture is run by people who put in a tremendous amount of time to support and help others and be generous. And I was kind of really amazed when I watched, you know, my son went through the whole Little League cycle here in Redwood City. And it was a great thing for these little boys to be involved in Little League. And you know, there's hundreds of adults who volunteered a tremendous amount of time freely in order to have these kids to be able to have this experience growing up of Little League. When he was about, I don't know how old he was, maybe eight. He was already in the Little League cycle, but he showed up for the first day of spring practice. And one of those volunteer coaches received them and had them all sit in the dugout. And he faced them, and the first thing he said to them, "You are sitting in hollow ground." And I don't know if the kids heard it, but you know, he saw this as kind of sacred, what he was offering kids, what they're for American culture at least. And anyway, so this generosity thing, it's a beautiful thing. There's a lot of it, and I think too often in our culture, the stresses that people have in their lives all too often make it difficult to appreciate and value and relax around the level of generosity we have. And then the Buddha talked about morality or virtue. And when I was younger, quite a bit younger, kind of a hippie, and I had no interest in virtue, moral purity. And luckily, I didn't have enough imagination to be immoral. So that was good. But I didn't think highly of that kind of thing. So until I went to Thailand and practiced the mindfulness of Vipassana in Thailand, and in those long retreats that I first sat, I experienced a degree of inner purity, cleanliness, that I'd never known before. And it brought me a lot of joy. I said, oh, that is interesting. That's possible. Then I said, oh, those people. And then I started getting really inspired and happy and glad by the people that I encountered who seemed to be very virtuous, and especially people who seemed virtuous easily without any expectation that I should be or others should be, you know, the virtue police, you know, telling you what you should be. This idea of being virtuous, and so this idea inspired by that. So the Buddha talked about generosity. I imagine he was talking about it in a way that inspired the audience. And then he talked about virtue, which I imagine continued that inspiration. And then he talked to people about the heavens. And in ancient India, they believed in realms of heavenly realms where people can get reborn in. And I'm not sure what that teaching was about, but one of the teachings we do know existed in the ancient world is that if you were careful and lived a virtuous life, a generous life, then one of the results of that is to be reborn in your next lifetime in heavenly realms where there's lots of bliss, lots of happiness and joy, much more than here in this world that we live in. So the idea that generosity and virtue is connected to this wonderful result probably in the ancient world greatly inspired people. For me, it's enough to be inspired by the great good that generosity and virtue does for the world around us, and what it does to our own hearts, the way that it nourishes and feeds ourselves. That inspires me. And then the Buddha talked about the dangers of sense desire, you know, the whole realm of all the different senses that's chasing after it. And we don't have to go too far in our society to see the dangers of people pursuing sense desire, sometimes to their death. You know, that's in a variety of different ways. And you see the danger of that. And so I don't know if that's inspiring in the same way, but it's certainly motivating to avoid some of those dangers. And then the Buddha talked about the bliss of renunciation, which I've been told in American society is not a very popular Dharma talk to give. But it should be, because renunciation is not so much about depriving ourselves, not at all about depriving ourselves or diminishing ourselves. The idea of renunciation in Buddhism is meant to be something that enhances us. We benefit from it. We let go of things which diminish us so that we can benefit, expand the heart in beautiful ways. And it's perhaps unfortunate that the word, Pali word, nekamma, was translated as renunciation into English, because maybe renunciation has kind of heavy connotations for some people. But the word nekamma has more connotations of going forth. And I think of it as like going forth. If you have been holed up with all your relatives, who you kind of like, but all your relatives in a one-room cabin all winter long, snowed in, can't leave. You know, that's a bit trying, maybe. And then finally, the spring comes and the snow thaws and you can finally leave that cabin. You go forth, you come out of the cabin, and so the freshness, the open air, the expansiveness, the freedom that that going forth provides is, you know, makes you super happy for a little while. Wow, you know, it's like, what a relief. So that's more the connotations of this idea of renunciation in Buddhism, the bliss of renunciation. It's more like freeing ourselves from the contractions and the heaviness and the weight being weighed down by some of the pursuits and activities we do that, you know, that are not really for our betterment, not really for opening us up. We think they're for our betterment. The pursuit of comfort, the pursuit of safety, the pursuit of status, many things that we pursue that sometimes just takes a lot of work to maintain and keep going and searching and, you know, working for and all that. And so the idea is to kind of be enhanced by moving forth and out of the activities that keep us kind of limited. So I can imagine that the Buddha gave this talk and that was inspiring for people to hear this possibility. So this talk was a journey of sorts that got people's attention and focus and interest in, and really interest in what was going to happen next. And so the Buddha was, in this particular example I was giving, he was focusing on the leper, this man who was quite sick and probably a little bit of an outcast. And when he saw that the leper was ready, that his mind was ready, receptive, free from hindrances, elated and confident. Someone who's, you know, my guess is being a leper is pretty uncomfortable. And to get his attention and focus, you can imagine he was sitting there at the edge of the crowd watching, rapt and interested, really, where's this going? And his mind was changed momentarily in that being inspired by this Dharma talk. And then this text goes on and says, the Buddha then expounded to him the teaching special to the Buddhas. So this is where they kind of the insight teachings about the insight are being offered. But remember, it's a receptive, quiet, steady, still mind that you're kind of on the edge of its seat, kind of ready to listen. And not just ready to listen, but to go along almost like a guided meditation, almost through an act of imagination to go along, follow along with this simple teaching that's going to be offered. And so the special teachings of the Buddhas, which is suffering, its arising, its cessation, and the path. Now, most likely he gave longer teachings than just those list of those four words. But it didn't have to be too much longer, because what he was teaching here was this core insight into impermanence, that things arise and they pass. And our suffering has a certain kind of impermanence to it, where it's inconstant. It comes and it goes. And, you know, we can talk about, we use the word impermanence repeatedly in talking about this central Buddhist insight. It's already been talked about too many times, and I probably use the word too much this evening. But I think after a while, people listen to Buddhism, Buddhist teachings a lot, the word impermanence just kind of, you know, goes right by without really going very deep. The word that's translated as impermanence is anicca. And nicca means constant, and a means not. So not constant, inconstant. So it's a little bit different connotations than the English word impermanence. Impermanence has a suggestion for many people that it's not going to last. At some point it's going to end. So we might as well enjoy it now because it's impermanent. Inconstant has a different meaning. That means that it might last, but it comes and goes. Like daytime is not impermanent in the sense that once, you know, I guess sooner or later, in some few billion years, it'll stop for us. But you know, ordinarily, it doesn't disappear once and for all. It only disappears in the evening at dusk, and then it reappears the next morning. And so the days are inconstant. They come, they go. The weather is inconstant more than impermanent, if impermanent means like it comes to its end. And so what the Buddha was pointing to was how things are inconstant. And the more quiet you can be in the mind, and more clear the mind can be, the more you experience that how inconstant our experience of the world is, the more we sense and see the inconstancy of it all. And things are constantly changing. And one of the things that makes them constantly changing is that our mind, ordinarily, is not very steady. It kind of jumps around. You know, if you look at your mind when you're driving on the freeway, at your attention, what your attention is doing. If you pay careful attention, you'll see that your attention is moving constantly around. Good driving, you're moving constantly your attention around. You're looking in front, you're looking in the rear of your mirror, the side of your mirror, you're looking left and right. You're kind of tracking all the information. In between that, you're thinking about the taxes you didn't pay. And you might be thinking about that a lot, and it might look like you're only thinking about your taxes. But in fact, you're thinking about an intermittent fashion. It's inconstant because you're also constantly jumping around other things. And then you're probably thinking about other things and focusing on other things, and then you notice you're uncomfortable in your seat and you sit up straighter or you readjust. And there's a constant movement of the mind around and around and around. And this constant movement of the mind is invisible sometimes, or if we're kind of too preoccupied with certain themes. Certain things were kind of like the taxes I didn't pay, right? So like I keep thinking, coming back to that. So it looks like that's all we think about. Or if we have certain strong moods, depressions or sadness or other things, it might seem like it's constant, but if you start really tuning in slowly, you see that actually the mind is not constantly there. It's there and not there and not there. And you might feel like you're really blue and upset or angry about something and think that I'm just so angry and pissed off, and that's the way it is. You're driving along your car all steaming and you're like, this is never going to go away. And then a police car comes up right behind you. And their siren isn't on or anything, but they're just like, whoop, tailgating right behind you, right? And probably for a few moments, you don't think about anything about your mood. You're like thinking about police car. You know, what does that mean? And then they zip by you and go away, and then you feel maybe a momentary relief, and then there's ample time to go back to your mood. But the mood wasn't, you know, it wasn't so constant. It was a little bit broken up, you know, changing, this inconstant nature. So this is what the Buddha was pointing to, was the inconstant nature of suffering. Suffering is there, it arises, and it ceases. And the seeing this arising and ceasing is a powerful insight, which I'll just try to describe in a little bit why it is. As a result of this insight, the Buddha pointing to this, and this leper, you know, really kind of being right there and perhaps applying it to himself at that moment, seeing it in himself as in that moment. And the text says, just as a clean cloth with all marks removed, all spots removed, would take dye evenly, so too, while the leper sat there, the spotless, immaculate vision of the Dharma arose in him. So something awoke in him, some clear vision. It's here in English at least, spotless, immaculate vision. So it's a mind that can be receptive, like a cloth receives a dye. And again, it's talking about how the mind is prepared. If you don't just walk off the street to have a mind like that. This is one of the reasons we meditate, is to soften and open and prepare the mind so that it's ready to take the dye, the teachings, or have insight. In this case, the insight comes from the Buddha. And then this leper exclaimed, he got something, he understood something, and this is what he understood. So he exclaimed this: all that is subject to arising is subject to cessation. So we're back to this inconstant nature. Everything that arises, everything that has a nature to arise, has a nature to cease. To arise and pass, to arise and pass. Some things pass once and for all, some things come back, but they have the nature of arise and pass. If things arise and pass, what happens in between the passing and the next arising? Who are you in between your thoughts? The arising of a thought, the passing of it, and so between the passing of one thought and the rising of the next, who are you? Who are you if you're in that moment, you're not using thoughts to tell yourself? Mostly we tell ourselves stories about ourselves through our thoughts, but the thoughts are inconstant. And who are we in the gap between thoughts? You know, most people ignore the gap because the thoughts are so mesmerizing. But if the mind quiets down, slows down, and gets calmer, then we start seeing that thoughts don't happen so rapidly. And we start seeing there's more going on here than just thinking. There's space between the thoughts, around the thoughts. And what's going on there? Who is that? Who are you? What's bright? Is there some freedom? What's there in that gap? So this man was quite elated, and he said, all that is subject to arising is subject to cessation. And he saw the Dharma, attained the Dharma, understood the Dharma, fathomed the Dharma, went beyond doubt, did away with perplexity, and became independent in the Dharma. I think I love this expression, independent in the Dharma, because now you know yourself what the Dharma is. So there's something about seeing impermanence, seeing the arising and passing of things. If you have insight into it and really see it in a powerful way, helps you become independent in your life, certain kind of independence and freedom. So why is that? What is it about this experience of seeing arising and passing. So imagine a person who, imagine you maybe, who has all kinds of interests, all kinds of things you like to have and want and do, and, you know, let's say things that you want, all the things you ever wanted in your life. Gather them all together, the whole shebang, all the things. And say that you got them. But once you got them, somehow magically, some string attached them to your body, never to be let go of, without the scissors to cut the string. And, you know, the first thing you got was great, but after the hundredth, the thousandth, like you can hardly move anymore, you're way down. And then someone comes along and says, you know, you don't have to go around carrying all those things all the time. You could, take some of those off. Some of them you untie, or here's some scissors, and you can cut them off. And so you do, and more, and finally you're kind of like, wow, this is pretty cool, pretty wonderful. I feel so free, so light, so, you know, liberated from all that weight. This is great. So it's a little bit like that with our mind, our awareness. That our awareness generally is tied to what we're aware of. It's tied and focused on what we're engaged in. Awareness arises in relationship. This is kind of a Buddhist psychology thing. Consciousness arises with what we're aware of. So my awareness of this glass only happens because I can see this glass. It's here. The glass is here, and awareness of the glass occurs. Awareness of a thought happens because a thought happened. So that kind of awareness, where the awareness that arises of a particular thing, can arise innocently, can arise where just it arises and it goes, and nothing. No, it doesn't stick. But often, it sticks. We have desires, aversions, judgments, delusions in relationship to those things. And it's like we get weighed down by them. We're stuck by them. We're caught in them. And a lot of the stress that we have is not because of the things we do, but really has to do with how we've been tied up in the thoughts, the desires, the wishes, the fears, and the constancy of it. We're kind of like tied to it or weighed down by it. So it's possible to have, it's possible to have that. Have this big Buddhist book of scriptures in here in front of me, and I can see this book as just a book. The awareness of the book arises, the book. But I may Dharma teacher of some renown in Redwood City on Birch Street. So I have a reputation to keep. And so now I'm concerned that maybe I brought the wrong book to demonstrate my worth as a Dharma teacher. And I want to make sure you realize, but you know, that, you know, this is a good book to judge me by. And I could get all wrapped up about, you know, how important, you know, it is for you to judge me appropriately by having the right book. So you recognize me as a, you know, the great teacher at 108 Birch Street. And so it isn't just seeing the book and letting it go through, you know, just there. I've gotten wrapped up in the book and what it means for me, wrapped up in my, all kinds of things, you know. It's complicated in there. If it's possible, I can just see this as a book, and it doesn't sting. Nothing happens. It just goes right through. It's just a book. I put it down. Or it could be that I'm thinking about the book for the next week. Now I might be thinking about, why did I use that as an example? What a foolish example. And I'll spend the next week thinking about this foolish example and, you know, just, you know, caught up in that, tied up in that. So, you know, that's the example of being tied and caught in something. I'm attached to it, I'm involved in it, long after the book is gone, long after you've gone this evening, I'm still tied up in it and involved. So much of the activity of the mind, what we know and we're involved in, we're tied up in, that we're attached to, we're carrying it with us. And a lot of the stress we have, a lot of the suffering comes from all those knots that we're caught up in it. As the mind gets calmer and quieter, stiller, like through meditation, and more receptive, then it begins to put down some of these things we've been carrying in our mind. And that's why the mind tends to get calmer, because we're putting things down, at least temporarily. And as we start putting things down, then we start seeing how the nature of awareness of how the mind operates is constantly arising and passing. Our thoughts arise and pass. Our feelings arise and pass. Our perceptions arise and pass. Our moods arise and pass. And to really get to the place where we can watch this arising and passing, this inconstant nature of it all, we see it arise, and we see that momentarily it might cease. It's not there, only to arise again. When it ceases, in that ceasing, there are no more strings. We're not attached to it anymore, even though it might come up. And there's this going forth into the open spring, you know, from the mountains. There's this feeling of freedom, of ease, of being not bounded, being unlimited, being relieved from all the strings and attachments we have. To see that it's possible. And so to see, yes, all things that arise will cease. And in that ceasing, the heart has been set free. The heart, as the mind, has been is no more contracted or bound or tied in by what is. And in that freedom, to really have a visceral, direct insight into that freedom that arises when we're no longer tied to anything, and to know that that's possible can give a person so much confidence and understand something so important that spiritually, the Buddhist tradition says, you become independent in the Dharma. You no longer have any doubt, no longer confused about things, because then you understand that freedom, you understand something of what the real freedom is, that the real spiritual freedom comes when there's nothing that we're tied up in. You don't have to understand a lot of complicated teachings. You don't have to have some kind of complicated, great attainment. It's just simply in that space where things cease, we understand. Now we understand, oh, that's freedom. It's available right here. It's not far away. And that becomes the work then of practice, of continuing to do this work of being able to settle and quiet enough to have the insight, the clear seeing into the arising and passing of phenomena. Not all the time, but you know, in meditation at certain times, so that we can use that the massage of arising and ceasing to help us to put down more and more strings, to let untie more and more knots. And the word that the Buddha used for the movement of liberation is the abandoning or doing away with the knots, the Pali word for knots, some yojana. And putting, untying, unraveling this stuff. So this is my understanding of why this seeing impermanence, seeing arising and passing is so important. It's not giving validation to the world of impermanence. It's not saying, you know, it's not a judgment or an idea about how the world is, but rather it's the ability to see the inconstant nature of our experience shows the mind, teaches the mind, the heart, something about a profound level of liberation, of being unbounded, becoming unlimited, becoming no longer weighed down, no longer contracted. So that the mind has a kind of, you know, moves out into a great space of freedom. So, to take that journey, it's a wonderful journey. And to know there is a journey that you can take is the journey. This is one description of the Buddhist journey, is to go take this, do those things, the generosity, the ethics, the acts of letting go, the acts of developing a calm and clear, steady mind, so that we can find ourselves inspired and settled and happy and engaged, elated enough, so that this insight into arising and passing can be liberating. So, maybe this week you can pay a little more extra attention to your daily, ordinary experience and watch how your mind, how quickly your mind moves between things, moves between what it's paying attention to and taking up. And you might see that it moves around much more quickly than you probably have realized before, jumps around. And in doing that, maybe you can see, is there freedom to be found in between, on the other side of? And what are you tied up in? And what can you untie? Great. Thank you.